everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the TetraCast. This is RPG Site's weekly podcast where we get the site staff together to talk about our favorite genre of video games. I'm your host. My name is Brian Vitale. Joining me, I've got Josh Torres.
Howdy.
Adam Vitale.
Hello.
James Galizio.
Hey, folks.
Oh, there he is. Chapman Wu.
How's it going?
And joining us for the first time on the podcast, we have Paul Shkreli.
Hey, everyone.
So Paul is a longtime contributor to RPG Site. He's done several reviews and some news and other features for us. But this is your first time on the TetraCast, so welcome to the podcast, Paul.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So for this week's podcast, our first game, our main topic for this week is going to be the recently released remastered collection of Lunar Remastered Collection, just released a day ago at the time of recording. Paul wrote the review for us and has that up on the site at rpgsite.net. So we decided to give him a phone call, get him on the podcast to talk about Lunar this week. And then also, I do know that Chow will also be contributing heavily to this discussion because you have previously played Lunar. You've played the remaster. You put up some guide features for the remaster on the site. So it'll be back and forth between you and Paul at the very least. Lunar is a blind spot for me because I do not really know much about it. I do not really know the premise. All I know is that it's like, oh, it's one of those 90s RPGs, right? I think. I don't remember. Before we go on, has anyone else played the original Lunar Silver Sard story? Or I say original, I gotta be careful with my language here.
Let me just jump in and also say I have not played Lunar. I know there's like a Sega CD version. I know there's like a PlayStation 1 version. I know there's like a PSP version for the first game. I played Grandia, which I understand is like the follow-up. So that's kind of like when I get around to playing this remaster, that'll be like my point of context. It's like, okay, this is the precursor to Grandia from Game Arts. But no, I have not played these. This is also a blind spot for me.
For me, PlayStation personally. 1 version of one of them. I don't remember which, but my only really outstanding memory of these Lunar games is like it has like really sick anime looking cutscenes on the PlayStation 1, and that was sort of like a novel feature in the West at the time when they released.
You guys are missing out. I treat these as the OG Trails games, okay?
So
what makes the Lunar game so very special is the story, really, because when the game first came out, there wasn't much RPGs like that where the NPCs got lots of things interesting to talk about. And I can even tell you, okay, does this sound familiar? Okay, some legendary hero brings a kid into the household, and then they grew up together and they go on an adventure. Does this sound something familiar to you?
They're saying Falcom ripped off Lunar.
Probably did.
We'll get the microphone over to Paul to start out, because Paul, like I teed up, you did write up the review for the remastered collection. So just kind of tell us about your time with Lunar, either the original, the remastered, what you've played previously. I'll just kind of let you do whatever you feel is most, you know, at the top of your head about what you want to talk about.
Yeah, thanks so much. I love hearing Chow talk about it too, because I feel like we are both the resident Lunar like gearheads. I never played the Sega CD versions initially. I played the PlayStation versions. And for me, it was like, I'm like 12, 13 years old. I'm like a budding, I'm definitely into RPGs, JRPGs, and like just a little bit, like maybe a toe into anime at the time. So as I start my Sailor Moon collection here in my basement. The games were just great because they were just classic turn-based RPGs, especially the PlayStation 1 versions of these games. Just gorgeous cutscenes. The box, I've got two copies of Lunar 2, and I've got one of the Lunar 1. And just like they were collector's editions back when collector's editions were just full of just amazing stuff. You have like a leather-bound book with like a manual and a guide for the beginning portions, soundtracks, just, I mean, kit and caboodle. And then the cutscenes, like you had mentioned, Josh, they were just so gorgeously detailed and animated. People really loved them. And it's so I was so happy to hear about the remasters coming, because for years people have been like, oh, I want to play it. I'm not a huge fan of Silver Star Harmony, which is the PlayStation portable remake of Lunar or Silver Star and Silver Star Story Complete. I just don't like the graphic changes, the music changes, things like that.
I feel like the game's too slow, in my opinion. Like, if you ever played the PSP version, it's like, okay, these animations take forever. It's like, okay, I'm doing sword dance. Ooh, and you see like this animation shift, and it just takes like 10 seconds, and it just feels way too long, right?
And I don't like the sprites or anything. So I have that game, but I'm just not a big fan of it. So I'm a huge Lunar Silver Star Story Complete and Eternal Blue Complete enthusiast, because you know, it's really something to see that these games came out for the Sega CD, and as soon as they were done issuing the second one, they were like, you know, we got to go back and remake the first one to take advantage of the new generation of consoles. And so to see what this team is able to do, and this is kind of what I allude to in my review, it's so awesome to see, because we don't need a remake. The team who made this game already remade it once, and they did a really great job remaking it. And just this few tweaks that they give us, namely the high speed battle options, that's what makes the game great. And like, yes, I mean, people will detract the first Lunar because it's really like wash, rinse, and repeat for battles and strategy for boss fights.
There's only one strategy for Lunar 1.
Yeah.
It's like, buff and sword dance wafer.
And you know, Chow, it's funny because I was looking at Nash's spell list, and it's like, there's only three spells maybe of his that I've ever used in the game in any of my playthroughs.
I'll tell you, if you played the Sega CD version, Alex is not a sword god, okay? He's a magic god in the original Sega CD version. Like, okay, so if you ever played the Sega CD version, the story changes a lot. They basically rewrote half the story around like the midway through. And I understand why they rewrote the story, because in the original game, basically you go on an adventure with your friends, and Luna, you know, when you go into the boats to try to go to the big city, Luna basically just leaves you and you never see her again in the Sega CD version, right? And from the PlayStation version, they just rewrote the entire story for the next half. And I'm still kind of in debate. I don't know which version I prefer more. I think I prefer the Sega CD version more, because the story is a lot darker there. It's just
I like the Sega CD version too, but I only think that it's great to go back and play it after you've already played the remake, right? That makes the PlayStation and now the remastered versions, because you're able to really see the differences.
I guess to clarify for our audience, can you clarify that the Lunar Remastered Collection, what is the version that people are playing in this remastered collection? Because as we mentioned before, there's so many versions, so it could get pretty confusing if you don't lay it out for people what they're getting in this remastered collection.
So you've got the initial Sega CD versions of Lunar Silver Star and Lunar Eternal Blue that were then remade for the PlayStation and Sega Saturn. The Sega Saturn versions only came out in Japan, I believe. So then the PlayStation versions are Lunar Silver Star Story Complete and then Eternal Blue Complete. Those are the remakes that were released on PlayStation. When the remaster that you're picking up now for this generation of consoles will be a remastered version of the PlayStation remakes of Lunar 1 and 2 that will feature a like slightly modified version of the localization that is now infamous from Working Designs, who had included a lot of like pop culture references, some euphemisms, things like that that you would obviously never find.
I'm obviously missing some of them. I mean, the voice acting in the original is just, it's too nostalgia for me. I miss the original Galleon voice. I love him too much. He's just too good. But
they replace him. They replace like the really, he's like almost like
it's a Zhang Li from Genshin Impact. A lot of the new cast, if you play this, it's like the Genshin Impact cast or the current like popular anime voice actors, like Persona 3 Reload cast kind of thing.
Precisely. So the original Sega CD and PlayStation 1 versions, I'm dating myself, I'm almost 40, but Ashley Parker Angel, who is a singer from O-Town, a very like 1999 2000 like manufactured boy band, he's the voice of Alex, which is like one of those things that's like just kind of is funny to laugh at now. They replaced them, but honestly I don't really have that much of an affinity towards like the voice cast, because when I heard this voice cast that they used for the remastered collection, I mean, I think they did an excellent job.
So the voice cast for the remastered collection is new in both languages.
Yeah. I think
the Japanese language.
I actually did not know.
No, not the Japanese one. Just the English.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Only.
And then for people listening at home, there's, you know, then there's one more. So after Lunar 1 and 2 remakes come out, there's a DS sequel of sorts called Lunar Legend.
No. We won't talk. I'm sorry to cut you off, but nobody knows that there's a spin-off sequel called Lunar Magical School in the Sega Saturn.
Oh, I mean, I know that, man. I almost made a fan dub of that, of the OVA in college. And so there's Lunar Magic School, which also had, there's a Game Gear game. And I think there's one more maybe for Magic
it's
School.
There's a Sega Saturn remake. They made it on the Game Saturn Gear remake. First.
I would love for those to get localized. But then aside from this Lunar sequel for the DS, there's a remake of the first game. And so my review alludes to this as well. So Lunar 1 has been remade from Silver Star Story Complete, then Silver Star Harmony. And then again, this remaster is a version of the PlayStation edition of the games, which are, in my opinion, definitive. I think if you're looking for a definitive package of these games, you've got it with this remaster. McCall disagree with me because the iOS version has more options when it comes to like graphics and difficulty, things like that. I just prefer playing it. I love the package. Lunar 2 has been stuck to the PlayStation 2, 1 for 25 years, so it's nice to get them off into local or modern consoles.
I think the mobile version is on Android now too, actually, which is kind of... It came out, so it was on Lunar Touch, I think. Lunar Silver Story Touch, I think it's what it's called, is the iOS version. I think it's been on phones for like a decade, and then it just recently, actually, like I think last year, came out for Android too.
And they updated it with all those extra features last year for iOS when they released it for Android. Then even just this last week, they released another updated version of it, just with some like bug tweaks. It's just funny to see that they're really pouring the love into this mobile version.
I think the mobile version is being like produced by some company called Samoga, which I don't know anything about them, and I don't think they've released anything else. It might just be, I don't know, some super fan who somehow got the rights to create an iOS version of the game, like one or two people.
They did.
That's right, on Steam, actually.
And they're remaking, or maybe they've already redone it, but they were... Because the Vay mobile port is not great, right, when you look at it. And I think that they took it down and they're remaking it, or they've remade it. So I look forward to checking that out.
Interesting. So, for a lot of the... In the modern context, before this remaster came out, a lot of people knew Lunar in the modern context. Like, these are fucking expensive. You're trying to get a physical copy of them. They are just, like, ludicrously expensive if you're trying to get, like, an original PS1 copy. And there's some... And you know, because... It's so prohibitively expensive to a lot of people. And that kind of is like the Castlevania Rondo of Blood situation. It's like, man, this was just like some legendary game. Like, what is the actual gameplay? What is this game about? So kind of, for people who don't know Lunar at all, like, what is the general, like, how, like, what's the gameplay of the game? Like, how's the battle system? How's, like, the world exploration? What can people expect, you know, if they just don't know anything about Lunar?
Just very classic turn-based role-playing games with there's no ATB. I mean, you have to think these games initially came out in the early 90s. So to me, this is the quintessential 90s JRPG ride or die. I guess for those reasons, that's why I'm always singing its praises. I wish someone would hire me to write a book about this series. That's the best way to think about it. If you're thinking I'm going to turn on my Super Nintendo and play a JRPG just with some great anime cutscenes, that would be it. I feel like, Chow, I would love to hear how you characterize it.
That's how I would see it, too. It's like, okay, you know, imagine playing Final Fantasy IV back in the day. It's still one of the most beloved Final Fantasy, but it's very functionally limited, right? It's like, each character only has like a few abilities, and they have their class roles, basically, and that's basically the entire game going through that way, right? But it's like one of the most beloved Final Fantasy. It doesn't have all the crazy features some like compared to some of the newer games, right?
Yeah. You know?
So at least that's how I see it.
And in this game, it's like, are there classes in this game? Or
No class. But every character has their kind of role. Like, our main character is just good at everything, and then you have like a Luna or Jessica, which is like your healer, who's also good at physical attacks too, but they're not really specialized in physical attacks, but they're more of healing. And then you have Kyle, who joins you, who's a brute force like attacker. And then you have Nash, who is your magician. And
he's
then...
not even bad with a bow and arrow. You know what I mean, though? That's what I love about the game. It's like there's really, it's, and battles are so like the boss fights, it's really, you're repeating the same moves over and over. And that's probably the biggest qualm I have with the design, but again, it's 30 years old. It's a if you were to take a JRPG and turn it into like Saturday morning cartoon comfort food, this is Lunar, the series in a nutshell.
Yeah, I was looking up, I haven't played Lunar, like I said earlier, but I was looking up the Final Fantasy IV comparison. So Final Fantasy IV originally came out in 1991. Lunar originally came out just a year later. So that, you know, that seems like an apt comparison just in terms of like the time period when this game
released. And to compare the two, if you compare the original Lunar with Final Fantasy IV, it's like, I mean, really, it's like the Sega CD, it's like just like that power is really something to see how they were able to make something. So it really makes sense when you think about working designs. Again, please, someone hearing this, hire me to write a book about it. Working designs, the way like it, they were so ahead of the game and wanting to bring this over to the States because they could really see that something special was here and they really got their hooks into it. And I'm so grateful to them because if it weren't for them, I would never have, this game would not be a part of my like personal history. Right. I'm the person who, if I go ahead.
I was going to say, I know there's lots of like negative grievance over like working designs over their localization changes and stuff. And they've been stubborn about not giving out like the original cast for Gung Ho because the guy who owns the rights to it is like very stubborn and wants to like keep it or wants a lot of money for it or something like this. It's like the Harmony Gold of like video game localizations, right? So
yeah.
It's kind of painful to hear, but without them, these games would never be out there in the first place. So I can't really like hate them too much. It's like,
no, you can't. It's like, you remember it was 25 years ago. You saw that Working Designs logo on the outside of a box at a video game store. And it's like, I would stop dead in my tracks to see what the hell that box was. You know, Magic Knight Rare Earth. I mean, even that game, that was like a holy grail game of mine for so long. And it's just that they're, and you play that game and like you read some of the lines in the localization and you're like, this is not the way these characters talk in this.
I think of Working Designs like four kids, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Except like oddly horny four kids.
Yeah.
There's a very infamous scene. Like there's lots of like infamous lines in these Lunar games. Like my favorite one that's been cut out in the remaster is "Send in the clowns." There's a point where one of the characters betray you and he's like and he laughs like super hard and he says "Send in the clowns" and it's gone. I am so sad about
it's that. Like, Is there a Bill Clinton joke that was in Lunar 2 that I
no, I could have sworn Bill there Clinton was one joke I is in find. The Sega CD version.
Okay, all right.
So you won't find the Bill Clinton joke. But there's I also feel like one, this though. Video started the Dragon Ball Z meme, or the Dragon Ball Bridge meme, the one where it sounds like the villain's name's like yes, and your character's saying no. It's like it felt like watching. I feel like they inspired some of these lines or something like that. It felt really meme when you see
it. Yeah, in the remaster, is it still kind of this very loose, four kids-esque translation? Like, I heard, we've described
it's
it as,
basically
like,
the working. But, it's basically the working design translation, but the stuff that are seen, like, problematic in today's times are gone. Like, there's a bartender, basically, when you talk to him. He's like, it's like, I love the was it the bill like this town's mayor here because that guy lets me be a drunk and a sexist, like stuff like that are gone. And then there will be like Ruby saying the R word, like there's like stuff like that, like anything that's problematic stuff like that is gone. So
but that line from the bartender's line is in the iOS version, and so that's why, because initially I thought it was clean because I didn't see it in the remaster and I was like, oh, they must have been cleaned up. And then as I peeled back, I obviously found it.
He basically changed the line to like something like, oh, he's looking for a good bartender or a good singer. And that's kind of like in a new version. But in the iOS version, or so, as Paul says, he's looking for...
I remember thinking that, you know, the localization I thought was funny. I'm 12 years old, obviously. Playing it again, playing that localization from the PlayStation version, as an adult, like more recently, I found it to be kind of offensive, right? With some of the reasons that Chow had mentioned. It's like, as much as I want to hate on the localization from Working Designs, it's like, hey, I owe them that. I owe them some sort of like honor because they're the reason that I played so many of those games. And the cleanup that they've done now in this remaster, I feel like strikes a balance where it still has that youthful irreverence from the Working Designs localization without veering off into being offensive. And so there are some lines where I remember reading them being like, this is kind of childish. But, you know, they're trying to preserve the games as is. I think you can see that with the details to the graphical style rather than just remake it for a fourth time. So for that, I give them a little bit of respect. And
it's always interesting, like how, like, when you think about it, like 90s era, early aughts, like localization and how it was like perceived upon, right? Like, a lot of people these days, well, a good chunk of people, at least in the majority, when talking about localization these days, they want to be super faithful and, you know, they want to be as close to the Japanese script as possible. But then they have like a reverence for, like, you know, watching the Pokemon cartoon back in the day. It's like, that was definitely not like a faithful, you know, localization. But
yeah, Ash, that's how Jelly felt all that.
Yeah. So, yeah. And so, like, and I look at the working designs as a very, in that same lens of like 4Kids, like, as I mentioned earlier, where like it was a time and place and era type of thing where the spirit of their localizations, while it may not have been like the most accurate to the original Japanese script, it was like, as we've mentioned here, like very Saturday cartoon, like, you know, coded. In the sense that, like, you know, it's like when you're playing a working designs game, it is definitely like that slapstick comedy that, you know, around our age group worked for us because it was like we were playing a Saturday morning cartoon.
They should bring working designs back. I think what we should do, Josh, Chow, and I, we should start working designs back up. And the whole emphasis of the company would be, we want to take, bring us your games from overseas, and we will give it the most 1999 Saturday morning cartoon translation possible, including with Spice Girls and Bill Clinton references. You got it.
Look, you guys announced the Samurai Pizza Cat like game recently. It's like, has anyone actually watched that anime back in the day as kids?
I've seen a little bit of it, but I wasn't like a huge Samurai Pizza Cats person, but I'm familiar.
But that's how I feel about working design. That entire English script is like a parody of Japanese one, but then as you grew older, it's like, I want to find out how was the Japanese one. I hear it's more faithful, and you watch it, and it's like boring because it's like so straight laced, and you are like, you know, it's like now you're thinking about it, it's like maybe I do prefer the parody instead.
But that's the interesting thing, right? One of the most interesting ideas I've heard recently comes from Alexander O. Smith when he did a podcast with the Resident Arc YouTube channel. You know, lovely people there. I'm really talking about the, you know, recently, the localization of games and like the philosophy, and they've had to, you know, got the interview Alexander O. Smith about it, which is, you know, one of the most revered, highly respected people in that space. And one of the most interesting ideas that he pitched forth, that's like, it's not feasible, like the game industry would never do this, but like have multiple releases of a game in English, like how the Bible has it, where like there's different translations and interpretations of the Bible. So you have like the most like most straight, faithful, maybe dry laced translation local of a game, and release that as its own separate thing, and maybe have like the working designs esque version of a game, and release that as its own separate thing. So people have like multiple versions of a game localization that they can choose from. And like, I'm like, that's a really interesting and cool idea that would never happen. It would not make sense for 98% of people. But I really like that idea because I really would love to see how that would shake.
I'm turning on the machine.
We kind of get something similar to that where I know that Sega, when it comes to Like a Dragon games, sometimes like they'll have changes based off of whether you're playing in the dub or the sub.
And yeah, they have this actually. Like a Dragon. Yes, they
and cutscenes and anime cutscenes. They have this. Basically, if you watch the cutscenes in Japanese, they'll have the translation as the way it's dubbed in Japanese. But you switch to the English one, you basically get like the working design treatment. And you get this like right away for like the intro, because in the intro, basically Alex just kind of rants on about he wants to go on this adventure, and the dialogue would just end right there in the Japanese version, right? But in order to feel like the mouth movement in the working design, Null basically comes in and it's like, oh shoot, I forgot that we should go to Luna's rehearsal, and then it becomes a little longer, right? But the translation subtitles would match whatever is going on in the scene. And this is not a huge spoiler, but there's this boat song. Basically, when Luna goes like on this boat, she'll start singing the song, and in the English version, the lyrics is basically her don't know if she made the right choice or not, and then the Japanese version is more like she doesn't know if she loves Alex or not. It's just,
interesting.
And then the subtitles would match whatever she's singing, right? So
yeah.
Chow, so, which game do you like better?
I like Lunar Silver Star more than Eternal Blue. Eternal Blue is like a more epic game in every scale. It has better characters. It has everything. But the reason why I like Lunar Silver Star more than Eternal Blue is I feel the cast in Eternal Blue has no chemistry, and the cast in Silver Star has way too much chemistry. If you get what I'm saying.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
Too much.
It's like
I like it better too. I think there's just like the new. Even though I think that I like the gameplay of the second game better, right? Because there's the the first one is that's. I feel like that same way about I just reviewed it last month. I feel like everyone likes the second game better, but it's like, you know, the first one I played that one first, and that's even though I think the second game technically is better, I think the first one has my heart a little more.
Yeah, like the second game is like way more epic in scale and like everything. The music is like god tier. It's like everything is like so good about it, right? But like even the character has like darker and richer like backstories. But the first game, they just have like so much chemistry. It's like you're going to like a movie theaters with your friends, and they all invited their lovers together, and they're constantly bickering, and then your friends are like bickering each other, and then it just becomes like hilarious argument. You're just kind of sitting there and like, damn. And that's like what friends do, right? But like the cast in 2 doesn't do that, right? That's why I like the first one more, right?
How are the two games connected? For so, like, are they completely different? Like Final Fantasy, are they loosely connected? Are they straight sequels?
Just they're direct sequels. The second game takes place 1,000 years later. So you kind of see the effects were
direct, but extend. Okay, like direct in 1,000 years to me is like I can kind of see how that is. Okay.
Yeah, and to answer anything like in further detail is probably like a spoiler. So it's like I would just find out how they're connected and enjoy it. But I kind of view them as like to be just like loosely connected.
So let's talk about the state of the remastered collection. We mentioned that there's a high speed mode now. How's the general like performance? What versions you guys played, and any more like worthwhile improvements or enhancements that they added?
Played the PlayStation 4 version, I think, on the PS5, and it ran like a dream for both games. There's like one odd little like blurring filter that you can toggle off, which I did toggle off. And aside from when I first started it, I thought, okay, there isn't really a lot of improvements graphically, but then you realize that that's kind of what they're going for, right? It was weird to me that they even included the classic mode, because the remastered versions is still really faithful with background graphics, the sprites, everything like that. It's basically just using it like where it's like in the windowed mode where you're like using a quarter of your television screen.
It's like a 4x3 screen. It's like I think the thing that kind of bugs me is the CRT filter. You have to turn classic mode to turn that on, and then a lot of people don't know how to use CRT filters, because the best thing to use it is to scale your resolution to 720 and don't set to 4K, because that's when you get the perfect scaling, because I see people complain on Reddit. It's like, so
you're talking about me, because I wouldn't have no idea how to do it. I just popped it in my PS5 and remastered mode and just marveled how it looked exactly. Like, this is going to sound so strange. Chow, you might agree with me. I want the font on the bottom of the screen in combat, where it has the characters' names and their health. I want it to look like it did on the PlayStation version. And it does here, or at least enough to where like the nostalgia receptors are firing off. That I was like, okay, here I am. I'm sold. And even like the background, the environments, the battle backgrounds, they look stretched out and they look a little pixelated. I prefer that, because it's what was there in the first game, rather than in other remasters where they swap it out with like some RPG Maker looking stuff. So to me, this was a very successful remaster. They could improve it by adding some of the options that are in the mobile versions onto the console versions. And that would be the way to make this the definitive package. Honestly, it's like you have you could toggle between Saturn and PlayStation difficulty. You can do up to three times speed in the towns and dungeons as well.
Battles like the high speed or the
right. And I write in my review that really the environments, the towns and dungeons are all small enough to where it's like you don't really need the 3x speed. Where it's like otherwise you're like zipping so fast that you're like running into walls. but some people might want it. So if you wanted to make these small tweaks, and there's a few other additional like filter options, things like that. I don't know if there's a music option, but like you could add those if you wanted to. I just don't think that gung-ho is really, here's my pun, gung-ho on doing that, because A, it's developed by somebody else, right, that Adam had alluded to. And also you see that like some of the Grandia 1 hack job port that has like those Vaseline smear filter on the graphics, they haven't patched that in any of the, in those versions that have come out. So I think we've got what we're getting, and I think that it's good enough for me. I'm happy to be able to play this sitting on my couch, staring at my TV like I did 25 years ago.
Does it have like that Vaseline-ish smear on this, like the Grandia PC
version? Okay. No, it's not here, and that's why I was. That's why I gave it that my review. Oh my gosh, I would have like lambasted the thing, because it really does look just like it did. It was just like with the marginal tweaks. It's not like a pixel remaster. They're not going by and like updating it like the Square Enix did, but it looks good. I think it looks really good for what it's supposed to be.
Would you say that like you think that it's priced a little bit too high right now, or do you think, you know, it's like it's
is it $50?
It's $50.
You know what? It's $50 for two role playing games that if you wanted to go buy the physical copy of, you'd be spending $250. You know, to get this big box. So I think that for me, if it's hard to put a value on it, for me, yes, right. I spent 50 hours playing both of these games. Right. So okay. It's like, so to me, that's do you value entertainment at $1 an hour? I value entertainment at higher than that. Right. So, I think it's worth it to get it physically. It's like $54.99. I mean,
get it physically. Gung-ho didn't open pre-orders, and then they realized it's like there's just too much demand for this game, apparently. Because
there were Switch copies available last night, I saw. So I don't know if that, maybe people are going for the play. And they said that they were going to issue some more. If you, I'm probably going to get one because I want it to sit next to my two copies of Lunar 2. I think it's worth it. I think it's I don't know if it was like $70, I'd probably start thinking about it, but $50, I mean, wait till the
price is a bit
out.
Steep, but I'm willing to support it just because I love the series, right? So that's my opinion with it.
Yeah, it's one of those remasters that you thought would never come. Like, it's this announcement was like out of nowhere at that PlayStation State of Play or whatever it was. So it's definitely one of those ones that's like, whoa, that they actually did it,
especially showing up there, like, of all places. That was surprising.
And that's the same price as Tweak It in 1 and 2. So it's like, it's not like it's out of.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's not like it's completely out of line with a contemporary in that sense.
That's two PlayStation 1 RPG dual packs priced at the same price, remasters. So,
yeah.
Okay.
I also do want to mention there, this game does not auto save. I'm not sure it's been mentioned, but if you ever die, you're going to lose all those hours of progress if you forgot to save, or you're like an idiot like me who chose to play through Lunar Internal Blue like 5 hours and did not save.
You can save anywhere, which I know that in Lunar 2 you weren't able to. But that was like working designs too, like infamously added like a cost of saving in Lunar 2 because they wanted it to, like, I don't know, they wisely got rid of it here.
Okay, I actually read a handful of reviews for this game. I don't remember if this was from Paul's review or a different one, but I read that they actually did add or adjust item management compared to the originals.
They did.
So
something
that Suikoden did not do. Right?
Yeah, it was per person, right?
As I understand, everyone has like 6 slots inventory. The main character has, Ocarina in the original PlayStation version, because you had to play it near the end in order to see the ending. If you don't play it, you just straight up die, and that's like a working design change. I think they like to add things, they're like George Lucas with like the original Star Wars, they keep modifying, thinking that they'll make the story better or something like that, right? But yeah, but that's like one of the complaints that what people have with the PlayStation version is that Alex would lose one inventory slot because of the Ocarina, because you can't beat the game without it. So,
well, it'd be like you'd be in combat and it's like you'd be able to use the items that are in your slots, but nothing, but you, Gnoll, your little dragon buddy, would hold all your excess, but you'd have to like get it from him outside of combat in order to use it. So, and now when you're in battle, you're able just to use like the, everyone's using from the same bag. And it just makes it so much easier because you're not sitting like, oh no, I have to restart this boss battle because I forgot to remove everything and keep all my slots stocked up with silver lights or something like that to restore magic.
I was actually talking to someone at the Switch event. Sorry. I was talking to someone at the Switch event that I went to earlier this month who was playing the Lunar Remaster for review. They're like, if Gung Ho can adjust the item management in a Lunar Remaster, Konami should have done it for Suikoden, but they didn't.
Yeah, so they just didn't want to.
That was definitely, like, I love Suikoden. I love Suikoden, but that was definitely the biggest missed opportunity there. And, like, it's just kind of amusing in a way that, like, another remaster, like, not even a month later, or a month later, roughly, is like, oh, we did it.
Did that update ever come out? They said they were going to update to make some of the management, not overhaul it, but at least, like, if you're pulling it from storage, see if it was better than what you had equipped or something. I don't think that actually came out.
I don't know if they just detailed it. Or, yeah, I don't know. Yeah. First week, then, you mean? I'm not sure.
Yeah, yep. So what about the, I know you kind of talked about how the second game, you didn't like the cast as much, but, like, does the second game introduce, like, any new gameplay mechanics that the first game doesn't have, or is it just kind of, do the two games play similarly?
What's funny is the second game initially added, like, the auto battle function in the original Sega CD version, so that when they remade both games, they added the auto battle function from Lunar 2 until Lunar 1. So that they kind of, like, patch it in. But I think that's basically it for to answer your question.
2 is a lot more difficult game. In fact, there's a huge difficulty spike. If you played it as, like, me when I'm 12 years old, I thought the second game was very hard, technically.
Right? Oh, I thought the first game was hard when I was 12. It's like, you know, that the jellyfish boss that you fight on the ship in the very, like, opening hours, that was, like, my very first rage quit as, like, a 12-year-old. And here I am sailing through it now as an adult. You're like, what the hell?
No, I thought the second game was insane with difficulty. And the last boss in 2 is especially hard. You're literally like, this last boss just come in and just boom, you're dead. And you're like, what the fuck did I do? Like, but basically the second game, they added a lot of gameplay mechanics. So basically you can equip these quests. And when you equip it, you get, like, these extra abilities. So your character may be locked onto these skills. But with these quests, they could use, like, certain skills, like the white dragon protection.
You equip a quest?
Quest, that's what they call it.
How do you spell it? I guess.
Crest.
Oh yeah, sorry, you're quest and not crest. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, Kyle. And then you could use, like, skills assigned with what those crests are using, right? So that's, like, the biggest change in the second game, right? But there's lots of mechanics changes that seems kind of minor, but it kind of affect the battles overall. Like, one of the bosses, it's like they use this ability, it changes the environment, and then it constantly gives them a buff, and then you could try to use certain abilities to dispel these things. So there's certain things that changes, like, the battles a little bit, but it seems very minor, and you won't notice unless you, like, play it very in-depth, right? So, at least that's what I would say about the second game.
I know this might seem obvious, but I assume the recommendation is just to play both games in order.
Oh, yes.
What?
Yeah, and, like, again, talking about Suikoden, there are some people that are saying, you know, Suikoden 2 is so much better than 1. 1's kind of like a proto game. You might as well just play 2, though I am very glad I did play both.
Those people are wrong, yeah. By the way.
No, I'm with you.
Because if you play the second one, you can't go back and play the first one, because you're going to be like, this isn't as exciting. So why don't you play the first one? It's like 17 hours.
Direct connections. Direct connections. Like, there's, like, characters from original showing up later, and you're like, oh, what's he doing here? Or they will, like, reveal, like, a certain plot twist early, and then you're like, oh, it's like, yeah, you should just play them in order. You didn't look at my guides, okay? The comments don't leave a single comment for Lunar 2, but there's, like, 10 comments on Lunar 1, because, of course, people are going to play the first one first, right?
Yeah, you should. Play first, come on.
That is a good shout out, Chow. You did, obviously, Paul wrote the review for us, but then you did kind of do some walkthroughs for Lunar 1 and 2. And I know when I get these games installed, I'm definitely going to be, you know, taking advantage of those. I took advantage of Adam's Suikoden guides. I'm going to take advantage of your Saga guide versus Saga Frontier 2, that is. And then also these two Lunar remasters. So I'm excited to dive into this, because it's kind of been a
blind spot. I have a complaint, though. I have a complaint about these guides, though, and it's that they're coming out after my review for the game is coming out. Like, how am I able to use your review, Chow? I already played them.
Play it again. Talk to me.
Yeah. I'm like looking at this guide yesterday. I'm like, damn, I wish I had this when I was playing it. Instead, I had to go get my my Lunar One guide that's like 27 years old, and I'm
I'll beat up
thumbing
and
through
stuff.
it, and the pages are falling out. So it's like.
Like, okay, so I was kind of stupid. I was keep thinking like it's like the PlayStation version. So I keep thinking, did I miss out the promo? Okay, time to start a new game again. It's like it's still not popping up up again. And then it's like, oh wait, they're using the Japanese version. I am so stupid. I lost like 8 hours of progress.
Like these collectibles are in different spots because they're
Yeah,
based on the
like Wicked
original
Design made
Japanese
it
version.
way in the pain
Okay.
in the ass to get them. You literally like had to talk to like this one person like 4 times right at the beginning of the game, and then you forgot to talk to them. Oh, too bad, you missed out the picture. Well, the Japanese
Oh,
version is like they're
I
just
didn't
sold in
even
a shop.
bother. I was like, nope, if I want to see these pictures, I will look them up on the in the old guide, because I couldn't find a few of them, and I was looking at the old guide to do it, and so I finally just abandoned it for my playthrough.
It's a really pain in the ass. That's why I included both instructions because I kind of wrote it based on the PlayStation version initially, and then it's like, oh, then later on I figure out the problem, and then I added like the remastered collection. That's why there's those mistakes with like, well, you guys like, oh, you did the PlayStation version. It's like, I know, buddy. It's
You
like,
hear that, audience? That's some true service from Chow. You guys owe him a debt of gratitude.
least that's how it goes.
So, did you guys have any other like final points of discussion regarding these remasters that we haven't quite touched on? We touched on the release, we touched on the different versions, story, of course. Gameplay sounds like first game very straightforward, but you know, in a very
Didn't want
classic,
to mention some of the
nostalgic way.
cutscenes. Doesn't really look
We did
that
talk about
good.
those at the very beginning. Go ahead.
No, but I did want to mention some of the cutscenes don't look that good in this remaster. Like, one of my biggest gripes would be like the Lunar 2 opening. Like, it's like, okay, I know they probably just AI upscale everything, right? But one of the scenes is like completely pitch black. You can't see what's in the screen. And like, then I went back, is this just my monitor? Because I just bought an OLED recently. It's like, why is this part pitch black? And then I go back and watch like the PlayStation version, but oh yeah, you could see his face. It's like you can't see the face in that version. It's like I don't know. It's like some of the upscales just didn't fully did it right in my opinion. So at least that's one of my gripes. But one thing for sure is I do love the Lunar 2 opening. The music that goes along with it is great. Even though it's just some naked girl walking in this crystal palace, right?
And also,
Yeah,
palace.
I was like, that's peak right there. That's the best thing ever.
My final thought is just play these games. If you're like an RPG, JRPG, especially nerd, like, why aren't you gonna think about it? Like, these are classic games. They're freely available to you now. Just check them out and see what all the hubbub is about, and see, and let us know if you didn't like them.
So, yep, we got Paul's Lunar Remastered Collection review up on the site, rpgsite.net. We didn't mention it, but Mikhail did do a comparison. I have not seen this myself yet, but it's the PC port versus Steam Deck and mobile. So, you talked a little bit about the mobile differences in terms of like features that weren't brought into the remaster. I guess which one of those are you talking about?
It's just some quality of life, like about the 3x speed I touched on it a bit ago.
Oh,
Where
okay,
now
those games.
in the mo yeah, so like it's just some like graphical filters, some options for the speed, and then I don't think that there's a music option, but there's a wider breadth of graphical choices in the iOS option, oddly, than the remaster for Lunar One.
So it looks like me looking through Mikhail's feature, the one concern is that if you play not at 60 hertz, like if you're playing on an OLED, Steam Deck OLED, that's at 90 hertz, there's some scrolling issues. But if you play it at, if you lock the refresh rate to 60, it seems like it's fine.
Yeah, I
But
would say
otherwise, it
that's
works
a
out of the
common
box.
enough. I'd say that's a common enough issue that if you're playing something on OLED and it's not something that you think can run at 60 FPS, I mean, that you don't think can run at over 60 FPS, just like cap the refresh rate of the screen at 60 when you're playing a game that's going to run at 60, because like the frame pacing is always going to be at least a little bit off. Because it's not going to be an even distribution. So, like, the only other reason I would leave the screen at like 90 hertz is if you're going for like 45 FPS, because then that's like even. But yeah.
Meanwhile, my
I guess
eyes
when you
crossed
do.
listening to all of that. So yeah. I read that in Mikhail's review, and I just like was like, okay, for those who need to know, there you have it.
Mm-hmm. And then, like I've mentioned, Chow does have a few guides for the walkthroughs, as well as a few other different guides for the two games. And then we also have the launch trailer from Gung Ho. If you're still on the fence and you want to see another pretty trailer, there you go.
Honestly, call my cell phone if you don't want, if you're wondering why you should still play this game, and I will tell you.
Just ring Paul up, you know his number, and just let him convince you about why you should be playing these games. But no, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Paul. It's been really excellent to hear you talk about these games, your history with them, what they mean to you, your back and forth with Chow about your thoughts on these two games. Sounds like you're both kind of very well aligned in a lot of places about why these games are and continue to be special titles.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to chat with everyone and hear everyone's voice after like writing with everyone for so long. And I look forward to coming back again soon. Thanks again.
No, thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Paul.
Nice talking to you.
So Chow's or Paul's going to head out.
Yeah, you know, he's got kids that are going to wonder where he is if we keep him abducted for much longer than this.
I hear them fighting upstairs, so if you keep me here for much longer, they're going to end up being guest stars. So, and I don't think you guys can afford their union rates.
Oh, damn.
All right, thanks so much, guys.
Thank you. So,
see you, Paul. So thank you again, Chow, for bouncing off with Paul about the Lunar Remastered Collection titles. Before we go on to news, we have one other game I'm going to talk about here. This is a game we talked about just a few weeks ago when we got its release like window first confirmed. This is the Gundam G Generation Eternal mobile game. I don't remember the details. Josh, you'll have to team me up on specifically what this is in terms of G Generation calls and everything.
Yeah, so this is the newest entry in the G Generation series, SD Gundam G Generation Eternal. It's the first mobile entry in the series. There's been handheld titles in it, obviously, like PSP. I think there was one for DS. I don't remember. It's definitely for PSP for sure. Long-running series, been going on for quite some time now. This is an interesting one because the most two recent ones were G Generation Genesis and G Generation Crossrage. Both got English releases, but I believe only Crossrage got an official release in the West, while Genesis was one of those. It got an English release version, but it wasn't released in the West. It was like it meant for Southeast Asia, but you can go digitally import it or physically import it wherever you could through other channels on that. And this series it's a strategy RPG series. It's not too it's pretty different from Super Robot Wars, which a lot of people are familiar with. But both shared that they're both strategy RPGs, both have grids, but and moving against enemies on like an overworld battle arena and having like fancy animations when you select an attack and then it plays out an animation on the screen. But unlike Super Robot Wars, the G Generation series is primarily only Gundam focused. There's no other giant robot series that makes an appearance there. There's no Macross, no Gal Gaigar, no Evangelion in it. It's strictly Gundam, and so to fill out the roster, their rosters, a lot of the roster is grunt units. You see these like the Zakus, the Jims, and other grunt suits, many other grunt suits, the Tauruses from Gundam Wing, etc. And they are very development tree focused. Like I mentioned, like I believe just the last podcast, or maybe last time I mentioned G Generation, is like it's very leveling up grunt units and evolving them to more powerful units, much like Pokemon, where you start out with like a starter Pokemon and you level them up to like a certain level threshold, like level 30, and then you have the option to evolve them if you want. And that's G Generation the same way, where like, you level a Zaku up to, let's say, level 15, and then you can evolve that to Char's Red Zaku, so it'll have enhanced stats, more attacks, more capabilities, more options in battle. And so forth. And then you can go evolve that Red Zaku eventually, like maybe Char's Gelgu. And so forth. And, you know, you keep evolving that until, you know, you make some cool unit like Char, like the Char's Sazabi or the Zeong from the original Gundam.
Did I hear you right? Did you call this Gundam Pokemon?
Yeah, it's kind of like Gundam Pokemon. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So the and the, it's always weird when it comes to like generation and the cadence that they release. Where Gundam is primarily devised of like the Universal Century, which is the original Gundam, Zeta, Double Zeta, Crossbone, F91, like the classic timeline. And then there's the AU, the alternate universes of Gundam. And that'll have G Gundam, Gundam 00, Gundam Seed. Basically anything not UC. They all have their own different timelines that they work under. Where like Gundam Seed is like the cosmic era. Gundam Wing is like its own separate timeline. And G Gundam is its own separate timeline. But they're all in that banner of it's non-UC, therefore it's considered AU, which is alternate universe. So that's kind of the main distinguishers of Gundam. So how G Generation handles this is usually they'll have a version that's only UC era, like Genesis, that has this classic timeline, and then you have like Cross Rays, which has this alternate universe timeline where you know have a different Gundam series that are not UC compiled into one game, and then eventually after they released like one entry for UC and one entry for AU, they'll combine them in like this big ass like mishmash G Generation title where it has like a shitload of units from the UC timelines and a shitload of units from the AU series all jam-packed together in like one mega game. So that's what people were waiting for, right? They're like, okay, they released the Genesis, which had the UC series, and they have Cross Rays that has the AU series, and everyone's waiting for like the big fancy console PC entry that'll combine these two together and have like it to be a fucking awesome 10,000 hour game. Because these games are quite long if you're trying to like fully complete them. They have a shitload of content in them. So you know, as everyone's waiting for the next G Generation entry, they announced, hey, we're working on G Generation Eternal. It's a mobile game coming to iOS and Android, now available. Free to play title. And it is that like coveted UC and AU series mishmash where they're gonna have a bunch of these series there at first, and then they're gonna continually update it over time with even more series that they've you know disclosed and like in promo material, which is like a shitload of like you know it even has it'll even eventually contain like game only franchises like Gundam Extreme Versus, for example, like those units from that series will eventually come to G Generation Eternal because they're part of the series lineup in those trailers. It's like, fuck, man, this is like the mega G Generation game that everyone wants, but it's a mobile title. So it's one of those things that like, okay, me, I'm willing to give it a shot because I can handle it. I can do this. Let's see how it is. And it's also pulling at my heartstrings already because one of the series that's making its series debut for the first time in the G Generation series is, I believe it's pronounced Ecole or Ecole du Ciel. It's like a Gundam
like comic book, right?
Yeah, like it's the manga. Yeah, it's a really, really awesome like Gundam like side series. That's like, but it's like hardly ever shown like in any Gundam like related property ever.
Damn, it's like, I'm always interested to check this out now because it has that.
Yeah, exactly. It's like because like, the main protagonist is awesome, Asuna, and she has like one of the coolest units in the series with the Lissing or Signed. I'm not exactly sure. I'm not French. I'm sorry. I don't know how to pronounce these things. But so I'm like, fuck. Okay. And the game itself is really interesting where you can almost play this like as a single player game, almost free of the gacha. I'm not gonna say you can do it completely, but you know when you first boot up the game and you go through the tutorials, they'll give you a bunch of free gems to roll at the front because it's at its pre-registration campaign. Plus the, like, these landstone landmark, like 1 million downloads. Here's another free 10 roll for you. So the game gives you just a bunch of gems at the time of we're talking about, you know, when it barely come out. They gave you like 12,000 up front, and like it's 3,000 per roll. Plus there's other like things in the game that are outside of like those free rolls. Like, for example, outside of like those free gems to roll with, you have like this unlimited reroll banner where you can keep on rerolling the banner if you don't like the results, but it'll always have like one UR, which is the step above SSR in this game, UR unit. So you can keep on rerolling that same banner until you get the desired like UR unit that you want. And you have like a free, like some free tickets that they give out as well. It's really, really easy to re-roll an account in this game. And for people who don't know, re-rolling basically is when you download a title that has a gacha like banner system to it. If you don't like what you get, you would basically make a new account, whether the game allows you to like just delete it or delete your data in the game, or just delete the game upfront and re-download it. Just a mechanism in the game for you to delete your account and start a new account, and then try again and roll for the things that you want. So in this game, they make it very easy where after you do a tutorial once with the first account that you make, you can go delete the data of that account, and then when you start up the game again without having to do any new downloads, it gives you the option to skip to the tutorial, so you can basically go try again and roll all the resources that they give you for free within like 2 to 3 minutes. And that's a pretty luxurious thing in the gacha game space, where not every developer makes it this easy or that fast to re-roll their games. Where, you know, some people want like that really powerful start, and a lot of people are just like, I'll just go with what I got, you know, who cares? While some people are like, I really want something, I want to get it, or I really want like a powerful account off the bat. So this game makes re-rolling very easy. It fired off very bad neurons in my brain, where, you know, I'm willing to go through it, and I did. That was great. So, and like, so I got like an Exia, a Sazabi, Lasing from the Ecole du Ciel, and the warship from the Gundam 00. I forgot what it was called, the Ptolemy, I think. And the game is really weird, where it's like, there's actually like a game that totally separates itself from its gacha systems in here. So it like, the game is very, it's not an open world game or anything. It's very stage-based, node-based. You know, you go into a stage, and like the main story stages are like, at first you go through the original story of the first Gundam series. And the story sections are very, very basic, where it's like screenshots of the anime with a synopsis over it. Who fucking cares, honestly? It's like a very abridged telling what happened version of the series in screenshots. It's like, remember Dragon Quest Die, that console game? It's like that, but you don't care at all. Which is, at least this game is like, the gameplay is more fun than that game, but it was the most apt comparison that sprung into my mind. And you have two squads. When you're going through these stages, one squad is a free squad where any unit that you have, you can deploy them with any pilot freely. Squads are made up to 5 units and 5 pilots and 1 warship. So go ballistic with the, like, whatever you want that squad to be made up of, whether you rolled for the gacha or you developed it from the dev tree in the game, whatever you want, you can stick them in, as long as it adheres to terrain, because there are some units that can't be deployed into space stages, there are some units that can't be deployed into like amphibious stages or atmospheric stages because of the specs of that mobile suit, like the cannon specs. Like, you know, there's like some mobile suits, like, let's say like the Freedom Gundam from Gundam Seed with the big ass meteor packs that it gets at the end of the series, like, that's like space only, it can't be brought to land, you know, it's too heavy. So you can't deploy it in like those stages, but it can be deployed to a space stage. So as long as it adheres to the terrain that it can be deployed on, go free in that squad. Then there's another second squad that you fill up, and it has to be filled up with units and pilots that are part of that series that you're playing through. So like if you're going through like the first Gundam storyline, that squad, there's one squad that can only be filled up with units from that original Gundam series. So there can only be Zakus, Jims, the original Gundam, Gun Cannon, Gun Tank. You cannot have, like, say, the Strike Gundam or the Zeta Gundam or the Gundam Exia in that squad, because that squad could only be filled up with units from Mobile Suit Gundam, the original. If you want those other units, you have to put them in that free secondary squad. So it's kind of forcing you to also play tactically with one of the other squads that, like, sure, you may have gotten units that you rolled for that are part of the original Gundam series that can be stuck in there, but then for other series storylines, like you're going through Zeta Gundam, you cannot use it for that squad. It's like series restricted in that squad. So, like, let's say I didn't roll any mobile suits from the original Gundam. It's like, oh shit, what am I going to fill up this? What am I going to fill up the squad with? You get a few freebies, like when you start a series, like a few Zakus or Jims, but then it's up to you to go through the development diagram for that series and obtain resources, in-game resources like capital, and you can capture units in battle. There's a chance that you capture them when you defeat them. Instead of like being scrapped, they like join you as like units that you can just like freely deploy and are part of your squad. So it's up to you to figure out, like, hey, if I don't have any units from the original Gundam, to go through that series development diagram and start using in-game resources to basically do what I described as, like, hey, go level up this mobile suit, evolve it to something more powerful, and then there might be branches on that development diagram that, like, lead to different mobile suits. Then it's up to you to decide, okay, how do I want, what tree do I want to go down under? Because there might be a unit that you like more than the other, or because of terrain restraints, you know, you might want to go for this mobile suit over the other because the other option doesn't allow you to deploy it on certain stages or certain terrains of a stage. So there is actually like planning involved in the game that is totally separate from the gacha aspect of it, which is cool and weird. And it also makes you wish that, like, man, I wish this wasn't a mobile game. It's also, like, separated to the point that, like, let's say I developed a Freedom Gundam through the dev tree in the game. I can also roll a Freedom Gundam, like a UR Freedom Gundam. And there is, like, an aspect in this game where, like, if you obtain a duplicate of a unit, you can go use that duplicate to feed it into a unit, and it'll get like a 20% stat increase, and then the second dupe might be a 30% stat increase. But you cannot do that in between units that you freely obtained and units that you rolled for. Those are hard separate. Let's say I rolled a Freedom Gundam, and I developed a Freedom Gundam with in-game resources like that. These are two separate units. I cannot feed that Freedom Gundam that I developed into the one that I rolled. And the thing that separates them, like what makes them distinguishable as separate units, like utility-wise, is that the one that I rolled for has some better stats, but also has access to an EX attack that the freely developed one does not. So it has like a fancy, awesome like EX attack that's it's kind of like Super Robot Wars Double D in that sense, where like, you're rolling for an awesome attack. So in this case, you know, you rolled a unit that has like access to exclusive attack that its free version that it does not. That doesn't mean that like the free version is useless though, because you might not want that out in the field to like soak damage or like be additional support, and you can like, it's more easily upgradable stats wise because you can make dupes of that Freedom Gundam from the development tree and feed it into the ones that you already develop, so you can continually upgrade stats instead of like trying to roll for dupes of the Freedom Gundam that you rolled for. I don't know if this makes sense or there's like ramblings of a madman. I get it. I like forgot for a second.
I can tell you the comparison that I was making in my head, even if it's not quite exactly the same. It's a little less tactical, but the way you describe this to me, I haven't played the most recent one, but I'm thinking like the PS2, PS3 era of like the Lego games, where if you're playing through Lego Star Wars or Lego Lord of the Rings or whatever, and you have and you're playing like the story mode, then you can only use characters that were present at the time. And that's kind of how it was only having like so you, like and how those games work, not to get too much of a tangent, is that there's like different classes of Legos, like Star Wars, there's astromech droids, there's bounty hunters, there's Jedi, whatever. But you can only have R2 in the original trilogy because there isn't another one until you unlock free play. Then you can unlock and use whatever astromech droid you got. And that's kind of like, oh, you can only use gun tank or gun cannon in the original Gundam show, unless you can fit it in this other, and you're like custom warship, then you can use it. So if you're wondering if you sound like a madman here, I'm kind of like drawing like tethers, like, it's kind of like using I don't know, like Obi-Wan in the future trilogy of Star Wars and Lego Star Wars. Yeah, totally like that.
And the way you describe about a free unit and the pulling dupes to get very special attack, I'm just thinking like Fate Grand Order, Noble Phantasma getting upgraded.
Kinda. So it's, but like, if you, it is totally possible for you to just roll the units that you get and not use any of them and just use the ones that like you obtain either through like in-game stages and just develop the shit out of them through development trees, because you can make dupes as much as you want as long as you have the resources for it, whether it's like, you know, the capital, like the materials, the metals that you get in stages. Like you can freely like just make squads of units that you only that you did not roll for at all in this game. It is entirely possible, and it is entirely possibly to be successful with that. It just involves a lot of grinding, of course, but it is totally possible for you to play this game totally separate from the gacha aspect if you're willing to make that like commitment to it, which is, I think, is really fascinating. And also at the same time, it's like I kind of wish it just wasn't a mobile gacha game in the first place. But I think that giving you those tools and those avenues to like do that is interesting, because like getting the pilots to fill those out is like you kind of just get buy pilots with in-game resources, like in-game gold, not of the gacha currency. Like you, there's like a pilot store in the game, and that gradually fills up as you do more main story stages. So let's say you completed this stage, like this beginning stages of Zeta. So you have like, you know, Roberto, civilian outfit Camille, and so forth available at the to buy with in-game gold, for you to put them into mobile suits. And then later on, as you're going through Zeta, you'll get, you know, Quatre, you'll get Fa, you'll get Cats, you'll get spacesuit Camille in there as well, and you can just buy them in in-game gold and put them on mobile suits. Of course, there are pilots that can be obtained for the gacha with their mobile suits, like say like Gundam Exia. If you get a UR Gundam Exia, then you get Setsuna along with them. And, you know, obviously they work well together. But you can put that Exia in other mobile suits as well if you want to. And obviously they have access to like maybe one or two more skills that makes them more valuable, but it's not necessarily like vital for them to be on your team to achieve any sort of like success at all. It's like, hey, you know, they're good at certain stuff, but that doesn't mean it's like a make it or break it type of deal. And also this there are like classes in this game, in sense like there's an attacker type unit, there's a support type unit, a defender type unit, and it's like kind of that almost holy trinity, where, you know, so but defenders can actually like, some of them have healing abilities, but some of the warships have healing abilities. You also have energy to manage with like your attacks, because all your attacks consume energy. Some warships restore energy, some you know, but also you get a little bit of energy back in between like rounds. And both supporters and defenders have like other mechanics going for them, not just purely DPS. Attackers are excel in DPS. Supporters can do support attacks, meaning that like if they're in range of like a nearby unit attacking, they can join in on the attack and do like increase like, you know, your DPS in the single action. Defenders, if a nearby unit is attacked, they can tank the incoming attack for them. They have higher defense stats. And there are like some stages in this game that's like they're pretty involved. They're not just like miniature versions of like battles in home titles. Like some of the later stages in like say Gundam Seed, for example, there's quite a lot of units that you have to think about that like, hey, these are really tough battles that I have to think about tactically. I can't just turn on auto and turn off my brain. I have to think about like, hey, all these grunt units have a lot of HP and they hit hard. So both of the squads that I deploy are deployed in different parts of the map, and I have to think about what their team compositions are, how do I keep them alive, and how do I make them effective so they're able to rendezvous with each other and make a united push towards the objective, you know? And that's kind of been like the most interesting part of me. It's like, even though there's a mobile entry in the series, I'm still thinking about like what I have to do in battle. It's not like just like a stat check that I can just like easily go through. It's like, oh, I have to really think about like how I'm gonna play this, because let's say there's a boss unit in the stage that does a lot of damage. There might be some turns that I just like I have to move my support defender units up front and not attack, so they can just like soak up damage on the next subsequent turn. And I have to make sure not to attack with certain characters, because if they attack and they get counterattacked, they're gonna take a lot of damage and might possibly die. So I have to actually like play somewhat defensively at times, where it's not just like a mindless, you know, turn on auto, steamroll everything. It's like, no, you have to like slow it down and think about like how you're maneuvering in battle, so you're able to be successful. So it's entirely possible for you to beat much higher difficulty stages that have like, let's say, a power rating recommendation of like 100,000, and like your power rating on your squads is like overall like 75,000. It's entirely possible to beat that stage, but you just have to think about like what you're doing every turn to pull that off. To me, that's like, okay, they actually like, there's actually an avenue to success here that like you can't just like, you know, swipe your card for and like roll 1,000 units. It's like, no, you actually have to think about like your party makeup and strategy on this. It's not like something that, you know, spend money and win automatically. So I there's gonna be a lot of like upcoming support for this game as they add more series over time. Right now they have, you start out with the original Gundam. After you're done with that, Gundam Seed and Zeta Gundam, a new translation, which is the movie version, opens up. So it's kind of a distinct thing where Zeta, the original TV Zeta Gundam series, and Zeta Gundam: A New Translation are like two, they're two distinctly different things, in the sense that like Zeta Gundam: A New Translation has a big change to the ending that the original Zeta Gundam does not. So I won't say what it is, but that's kind of interesting that like they used a new translation over the original Zeta Gundam. Then after that, you open up Double Zeta Gundam and Gundam Wing, and then from then on it branches out into like, you can do G Gundam, A Witch from Mercury, or I think Gundam X, and then so on. And like, there's already like a bunch of like handful of series included in this game. There's like a shitload of things to do. Like, this game takes time to get through, but the series lineup at launch is pretty cool and varied. They're going to add like other things over time. Like, I think the first like event is like Gundam Seed Ashtray, which is, you know, cool. I'm interested to see how the events work in this game. They also, one of the pre-registration rewards that they give out for free is that new unit from G Quax, the new Gundam series. You get that as a free unit as well, along with Machu, the new protagonist, though they don't, she's unvoiced at the moment. I wonder if they're gonna add her voice in the game. Maybe just one of those late additions, promo material that they'll go back and, like, you know, add her voice in. And I think, yeah, I mean, they also have, like, the white Gundam from Quax that was, like, that as part of, like, the original UC alternate storyline that, like, it's going for. Like, they have that in the game as well.
I've only seen the first episode, so I remember the black Gundam and the red Gundam. That's all I got.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and it's been too long since I've seen the original, because it's supposed to be like an alternative ending to the original or whatever.
Yeah, it's like an alternative of the UC. Yeah, yeah.
So the like I don't have. Yeah, apparently I need to catch up.
Yeah, you're fine. I mean, it'll make more sense when you see the second episode. Like, okay, that is what they're going for. Like, and it's not.
Now I'm gonna remind myself of. It was Super Robot Wars that was going to do Witch from Mercury, but just the first season. This yes. is saying it'll future support Witch from Mercury, specifically how, not detailed yet.
So yeah, this one, Witch from Mercury is already in the game, but I think it's probably season one content in G-Generation Eternal. And I imagine later on they'll get to like the later storyline. But I'm not exactly sure, like... Because I have yet to get there. I still have to get through. I barely finished Seed and Zeta Gundam. I have to get through Double Zeta and Wing. And then after I beat those, I have the branching path of whether I want to do G Gundam or Richard Mercury or Gundam X. So I think it's only season one in this game, but I'm not 100% sure. I have to imagine it's only season one, but I don't know how far they get into the storyline in G Generation Eternal. But you do have like the Aerial Gundam with Soletta. In the game is like one of the UR units that you can, you know, aim for. And I haven't seen other units from the game yet. But, you know, it's one of those... I think I would like this game more if at least had like a PC client version. I feel like that's been the case for like every mobile game. But even then, I kind of wish this was a console. This mega game was a console version. But I get it why they went this route. Because in interviews of this game... They really want this to be like almost like the definitive Gundam encyclopedia, featuring just like everything Gundam in one package, and that's financially feasible if they have a successful mobile game that continually gets revenue instead of like the one-time transaction with its players that has limited scope. This one is like at least they can continually update it over time if it continues to be successful. Which I get, you know, it stings a little that this is going to be the game, if it manages to have legs, that it'll be like the Gundam everything game, from super popular series to like very niche ones like the Seal, you know. So, yeah, I mean, I'm a sucker for Gundam, man. I'll keep on playing it. I'll continue to hope for the best. I'm cautious, but I think it's interesting the way that they went about doing it. Like, it definitely feels like, you know, the G Generation developers really tried to, like, kind of find the balance with this game. Whether it works out or not, I don't know, but I'm willing to be open-minded and give it a shot, because I like the G Generation series.
So, were the G Generation series previously not gacha games? Is this the first one of its type, or is it kind of a mixed bag?
There's the first gacha game in the mobile gacha game in the G Generation series. Up until this has been like home and handheld releases.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's kind of the first of its kind.
Was the gacha series under a different title? Or, like, I swear we talked about a gacha series in this vein before, but maybe I'm mistaken.
You might be thinking about like, there's other Gundam gacha games that weren't G Generation.
Gotcha, probably.
And there doesn't, like, you know, also SRW has also had gacha games. Like, one was like Cross Omega, which is out of service now, quite a few years now. And then you have SRW DD, which is still running in Japan.
Mm-hmm. So might have been SRW.
Yeah, might have been that. So, you know, keeping track of all this is a mess. But I don't know, man. Like, I enjoy it. I actually like do enjoy like the parts of the game where like I have to think about what I'm doing in the game, and it's cool when I get to like, you know, think about what I'm doing in the game. But I'm just like, I kind of wish this wasn't a mobile gacha game that I had to do this with. But I get it.
Yeah.
So it's okay. It's all right. I imagine it'll get more and more better. And I don't know. I don't know. I just think it's cool and also kind of weird and also kind of hopefully the gacha stuff doesn't really become that much of a pain point. Like at the moment, it doesn't. It's so out of the way, like it doesn't feel like the main focus point of the game. Like the main focus point of the game is really these development trees and diagrams per series, and like that's cool. That should continue to be the main focus, and hopefully that gacha stuff is just like more of a supplemental add-on rather than like be the focus, which is I hope that's how they change.
Yeah, I've heard you talk about gacha games and much, you know, more sour disposition than this here. So it seems like this is doing pretty a lot of things pretty leniently in terms of fairness or how much it expects you to, like you said, swipe versus auto battle only when your power level is a certain value or something like that.
Yeah.
And with that, I believe we'll go into one more article shout out and into some news. Not a lot of news this week. If there's a theme for this week, it's niche, like Japan only titles that are becoming available through different avenues to be played outside of Japan and outside of their original platforms. So we'll go into that. One other thing that we do have up on the site is we did get pretty recently in this month the PC port for Phantom Brave the Lost Hero. Of course, this was released on consoles back in January, and the PC port just came out a few weeks ago. Mikhail did do another comparison between...
Wait, is the PC port actually out or no? I don't...
Is it out? I thought it... Unfortunately, our little sidebar only shows the...
It comes out the 24th, which is the same day as the 100 line and Expedition 33. I think we talked about
that
before.
That rings a bell.
Where it's like,
we have a pre-order of what we're ditching and what we're playing. Hell yeah. Dinosaur.
Yeah. We should ask our site admin to like give us some like platform, I don't know, like pills to put under the on the sidebar so we could say the console versus PC release, because it only shows the original release, in this case console. But okay, so ahead of the PC release, thank you for the clarification. Mikhail did put up a comparison for the existing console ports versus the PC version on Steam Deck and ROG Ally. Yeah, in terms of news, a lot of stuff here that I do not feel like I have the authority to speak on very well. I'm going to start out with a classic Nihon Falcom RPG called Dinosaur. I believe we have talked about this, but I don't remember the context. Chow, is this something that you've played in the past? I'm trying to remember like how it got brought up on the podcast before.
Released on the Egg console, wasn't it?
That's today's news. I was trying to talk about like I remember it being brought up.
I believe I have not played Dinosaur. I don't know if we ever talked about it, but I know several years back, the GeoFront fan localization group started working on Dinosaur Resurrection. They're not done with it as of the moment.
Oh, that's what it was. It was Dinosaur Resurrection.
They're still working on it.
But there's a difference. Right, so, it's not Dinosaur Resurrection. It is the original Dinosaur.
So Dinosaur was released for the PC-88 in 1990, December 1990. And now through the Egg console, it is being available on Nintendo Switch. Now, Adam, remind me, what is the Egg console? I know you've gone over this before, but I don't remember.
Egg console is an emulator from D4 Enterprise for PC-88, I think a couple of different TurboGrafx or whatever they're called games on Switch. And there's also Project Egg, which is an emulator on PC. Falcom has released several of their classic games, or this Enterprise has released several Falcom games on the platform, that if you go to the eShop right now in North America or wherever, you can buy like the PC-88 version of East 1 and 2, of Xanadu, of Dragon Slayer, and now Dinosaur. The thing is that while some of the packaging is in English, like the emulation and some of the menus and stuff, the games themselves are just as they are in Japanese. But you can buy them in dollars and play them, which is cool.
Yeah, it's good. It's good that, like, you know, it provides some like legal way to, like, you know, get access to these games and, you know, throw a little support for them. And just through the initiative, right? I mean, even if they're not like official UI full English, you know, releases, just having access to them and being able to easily, you know, play them is, you know, without any setup or fuss is good, you know? And they're relatively pretty affordable as well. They're not asking for a lot of money for these releases.
And I'm watching the little the trailer for this from D4 Enterprises, and it's cool to see some of that classic, like, to me I associate this art style like with the East 1 and 2. Of course, I get confused on book versus complete versus collection. Like, I don't quite have those all delineated clearly in my head, but this does kind of evoke that same imagery, that same era of Falcom.
Classic game. Falcom era.
I think the first thing I heard about this game, it's called Dinosaur and it has nothing to do with dinosaurs.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, I remember that from the other conversation. Yeah, and then when Kite wrote up this news post about the egg console emulation of Dinosaur, how it did also then release for the PC 98 instead of PC 88, and then a Dinosaur Resurrection released on Windows 98 through Vista. So kind of
that's the remake of this game that the Geofront is working on.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, like Josh said, just kind of cool. This kind of just for the game's history and preservation's sake, just to have it available on in a modern setting.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the Egg Console and the Egg Initiative, pretty much. I really like what they're doing over there.
And then in a similar-ish vein for like a niche limited availability title being made more available through emulation, this is for more of those mid-2000s era feature phone games. We've talked about these in a few different contexts. There was the Persona 3 spinoff that was, I forget what console it was made available on, but you can now play, at least in Japan. We talked about the Xenosaga Pied Piper feature phone game. For this one, G-Mode is bringing Shin Megami Tensei 20XX to Nintendo Switch and Steam, along with Tokyo Requiem. Of course, these are Japanese feature phone games. I do not have any, you know, firsthand experience with these. But the Switch version of Shin Megami Tensei 20XX will be available on April 24th, and then it'll also come to Steam on May 8th. The dates for Tokyo Requiem haven't been dated yet. And then Kite did provide a few more informations here. Some feature phone Armored Core games are similarly being made available. Armored Core Mobile Mission will be available on Steam on April 30th. And then it's already available on Nintendo Switch, if I'm interpreting his news post correctly.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then Armored Core Mobile 2 is also being worked on for the same in the same vein.
Yeah, it was a big big week for just G-Mode announcements. Like, we talked previously about G-Mode in the Under the Console, like, in Persona 3, I guess, the first mission.
That's the one I was thinking of, yeah.
Yeah. And so, as you mentioned, G-Mode is, like, an initiative like the Egg Console where you're preserving, like, you know, fairly old, in this case, like, flip phone games that were exclusive to Japan, and now G-Mode has been partnering up with various, you know, publishers and developers in Japan to, you know, make these available on modern platforms that were just previously stuck on flip phones when they were, you know, more prevalent at the time. So it's really cool that they announced both Armored Core entries and Shin Megami Tensei entries both on Switch and eventually Steam as well. That's, once again, another really, really cool preservation initiative that I'm a big fan of. It's just, it's awesome that they're doing this, man. Like, we take it for granted.
Well, I was Googling around. I was wondering, like, did G-Mode say they were going to do Pied Piper? And apparently no, but you can, like, 2 years ago, there was a campaign to request that they work on it. Mm. And that one I have direct experience with. Anyone who's played Xenosaga 3 does, because
Xenosaga 3 just assumes you know it.
Yeah. And it's just like, what? Well, who are these characters? What did, was there a game I missed? And the answer is like, yeah, you kind of did between those two. Man, the mid-2000s was a weird time to be in like high school because, like, you know, before Crysis, you know, Pied Piper, all those, all these like games were before the original iPhone. You would just be like, well, I guess you might be able to find like a bootleg 300p someone who knows Japanese playing through it and translating on the fly version of the cutscenes, maybe.
You find like forum post synopses on these things.
Yeah,
pre-Wikipedia days. Yeah, you had to just whatever fucking Z boards or GeoCities or fuck anywhere on the internet at the time. Zanga.
Yep.
I mean, speaking Xenosaga, I specifically remember reading up on Pied Piper and The Missing Ear.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I forgot about The Missing Ear.
Both of those things you pretty much need to know before Xenosaga 3. So
it's awesome.
I could see actually like trying to play that if it was supported to in 3D mode, even like, you know, language barrier and all. I would give it an attempt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think they're fairly playable without.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know why I decided to open with those, but I just thought those were some pretty interesting news about some niche games with, you know, not exactly being made to be to, you know, shake the heavens or make a huge megaton announcement, but more really in the sense of just some really neat work being done by some smaller boutique, you know, groups in the sake love of preservation, in the sake of, you know, love for the genre. In terms of updates for existing games, we have a handful of ones here.
Before we get to that, can I just do this announcement real quick?
Sure.
Electronic Arts and Bitreactor announced Star Wars Zero Company. So, mm-hmm. Star Wars Zero Company was originally announced without a title about 3 years ago. Basically, EA said, we have several Star Wars games in development, and one of them is from a new company, an independent developer called Bitreactor, who they kind of work very closely with Respawn, who obviously did the Jedi Survivor games and the Jedi Fallen Order, those two games. The company itself, Bitreactor, was founded by, oh, let me get his name. It has a lot of Fire Axis veterans on the staff. And so those are the people behind like XCOM and maybe Marvel's Midnight Suns and things like that. It was founded by Greg Forch, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, who was the art director on the XCOM games. And so this is a tactical game, seemingly very much in the vein of XCOM. When this game was announced and it kind of like leaked ahead of time a little bit, it's one of those things that for our scope, like, is it more pure tactics or is it more tactical RPG? I don't know. Kind of straddles that line. I just kind of figured, we cover these sorts of tactical kind of games, XCOM-ish. I've covered games like Jagged Alliance, which is very tactical and only very lightly RPG. I reviewed
Marvel's Midnight Suns.
Yes, you did Marvel's Midnight Suns and you liked it quite a lot. Yes. So I just figured, and we covered XCOM. I know Alex was here. He would sing his praises. So yeah, this is the big announcement of the weekend, I guess. This was actually from Star Wars Celebration in Japan. And there was a couple of other shows and things they announced too. But
I will say I hear
Andor season 2 is really, really good.
Yeah.
And when I saw the, I don't know if thumbnail is not the right word, but the logo for, oh, they're remaking Star Wars Starfighter. Oh, wait, no, never mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, like, that's like a new project, but under like has the same name as a PS2 title.
Yep.
Anyways, this is a tactical game. It is set in the, quote, twilight of the Clone Wars, if you care.
I remember playing my PS2 copy of Star Wars Starfighter and being like, games couldn't look better than this. I was
that's right.
11.
So yeah, the before the trailer of this came out, the key art for this is really funny because it's like it's definitely like trying to evoke that the classic timeline era Star Wars feel. Like you just have this R2-D2-esque thing along with the like it's like squads. So you have like a Boba Fett looking one. You have your bounty hunter that's like sort of Han Solo-ish. I don't know the race of this thing, the person that's like holding a lightsaber is like an alien race. I'm not exactly sure which Star Wars alien races that is, but it's like it's meant to evoke that classic era, like, hey, if you were a fan of the original trilogy, you know, you'll probably like this type of thing with the squadron artwork. on it. And the new trailer that came out of this just recently was like, you know, your typical CGI trailer to set the mood and atmosphere, but then like at the last like 30 seconds of the trailer, you do see a little bit of like in-game gameplay, and as Adam mentioned, it's looking very much like an XCOM-ish take on the Star Wars series, with a lot of like maybe grid-based movement and taking cover and using abilities and working together as a squad to like take out like the opposition. Yeah, by positioning yourself, like taking advantage of like, you know, the environment and positioning yourself tactically against opponents. So this is I hope it's cool. I really hope it's cool. I'm very, very interested in this project.
No, and I think that's totally worth calling out, Adam. So
I think it was just announced like literally this morning or last night, and it was Japan time, so in the middle of the night for us. So yeah, I mean, it was leaked ahead of time, but the official announcement, I mean, so.
Yeah, so, a little bit of like the info in the game, like for the press release, is saying it's a campaign that where players will go on a tactical operations around the galaxy. You'll have a base of operations and gather intelligence. So this is sounding a lot more in the XCOM direction rather than the Marvel Midnight Suns direction in that sense. And then they're saying that like the main protagonist Hawk, I guess their appearance and combat class can be fully customized. While you're recruiting operatives, that could be, you know, from a range of like Star Wars character classes and species, and you can go tweak their appearances and loadouts as well, and their ability. So, you know, this might be really cool. I really hope it's really cool.
And this is like the sort of, you know, it feels like it's a Star Wars game out of time, like from an era where you'd get Star Wars games in every genre, like every year, until they like there was that dark period where there were none, and then Respawn, to their credit, brought them back, but like with the Fallen Order, but very much in like that AAA big, you know, open expanse sort of high budget, too big to fail sort of way. Though even though those games were, especially the second one, received very well, received highly as well.
Yeah, I'm excited for this too.
Yeah, but yeah, as Adam mentioned, Big Reactor saw a lot of X4Axis veterans on it, so just a lot of creative juices from the XCOM lineage at play. I can't wait to see more, to hear more, to learn more. It's definitely one of those projects that's like was immediately on my radar, and I was like, okay, there's something to this. The more they say, the more I'm like, okay, all right, keep on going.
Yeah. 2026, right, Adam?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, in terms of game updates for release games, here's a game that we've talked about its strong post-launch support a few times. Lords of the Fallen, this is the 2023 version released late that year, has been getting pretty decent post-launch support since its original launch. What we have here is the announcement of version 2.0. Of course, it's a big version number. It sounds like the main selling point for this big update for Lords of the Fallen is basically seamless co-op. So obviously Souls-like,
well,
depending on...
It had seamless co-op before. It's just the progression was linked to whoever was the host. So you would always you could play through the entire game. You just always had to have the same host when you did so. Now it's making it so that the progression is saved between the host and the person that connected. So it's just a minor thing. Seamless co-op was a thing. That was literally the big thing that they were really pushing about the game from the word go. So
gotcha. And I know like Elden Ring, not obviously a different developer, like seamless co-op is one of its most popular mods, because not all these games allow for that. It only allows for very specific avenues of cooperative play. And then in order to facilitate this, they're announcing a Friends Pass. So basically, even if you don't own the game, you can be the co-op partner for the host who does own the game from start to finish. So that's really cool. one of the big things here.
That's
there's also just general technical improvements. They made some differences to the character creator. Now, the way that they framed this is a bit silly. They said like
This is a follow-up on one of the main guys at the, I think, publisher basically putting his foot in his mouth. So it wasn't an accident. It was very much intentional.
Yeah, and that is, so the developer is Hexworks, the publisher is CI Games. Yeah, and the CEO of CI Games is a little bit of a knob, unfortunately. But publisher, and then Hexworks did support the game. And what this is just updating the, I guess when the game launched, the male and female were listed as type A, type B, which is not uncommon. Phantasy Star did it, Dragon Quest did it. Like, it wasn't something new. And apparently, I've read that that some of the cosmetic options for the female body type were very limited. So even though when you read it in the press release, it sounds kind of very specific, it actually was kind of a welcome improvement in some people's eyes. They've revamped the tutorial, they've revamped the overhaul. I guess there's some movement changes here. I've heard that like leaping into combat like moves you forward quite a weird amount that finally got fixed. It seems very specific, but I saw some people saying, like, finally, I can't believe they fixed your, like, how your character gets positioned when entering combat.
I watched the video for this, which is fairly long, like 5 or 6 or 7 minutes. And one of the things, first of all, this video kind of made me want to play this game, to be honest.
It's a good game. Like, unironically.
One of the things they talked about is actually, like, you stop more suddenly now, which makes it, you just have a little bit more, I guess, like finesse and control over your movements and actions. And like, if you stop suddenly and change directions or whatever in movement, where I guess before is maybe just a little bit more slip slidey.
That's probably a good thing, because there's definitely one specific section of the game where you're on some pretty narrow pathways over a cliff. And it was kind of a little bit easy to, while fighting enemies, to accidentally knock yourself off.
They also talked about how, like, when you're in combat, they adjusted the lock-on, so you're less likely to lock on the wrong thing. Which is, you know, I'm not exactly sure what...
As someone who's played Xenoblade Cross Definitive Edition, I feel that, where I'm like, please target the skull in front of me. Please, no, not him. Please target the right thing. So yes, any updates for games having a good working target?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what the problem was or necessarily what the solution was, but they were apparently aware that people were having issues with the lock-on, again, like locking onto the wrong thing, and so they tried to address it anyway.
I think it's funny that they have a dedicated jump button now. That was like one of the big
things. I was going to bring that up as well. Yeah.
It's like, in the end, maybe people, devs of the past were right to have dedicated jump buttons and try to phase that out over time. Was objectively wrong.
Yeah, I'll say that, like, it's kind of awkward nowadays because of some of the statements from, again, that CI Games person, but I've been pretty steadfast in saying that I think that this game is probably one of the better Souls-likes that I've played, and I think it's genuinely a bit underrated, especially now that it's, like, had, like, continued improvements for, like, the last year and a half. Like,
yeah.
It's genuinely real good.
Yeah, it's really astounding, like, their steadfastness and continue to support this game to the extent that they have, and just and now, just like, what, we're like almost like over a year and a half into its since its like first release, and now they're adding like a Friends Pass along with it and doing all these sorts of changes. Just genuinely, you can feel that, like, when you give feedback to these developers, you know that they're listening, and that feels good. Okay, because you as a person who wants to have fun with this game, you care about this game enough to give them feedback, and at least you know that, like, someone's actually listening at the other end, that at least they're thinking about it. Maybe they'll change things, maybe they won't, but at the very least, you know that, like, they're considering, you know, ways to make their product better.
Yeah, like I said, watching this trailer actually makes me want to play this game.
Another well-supported game ever since its launch, Baldur's Gate 3. So this is I feel like we've said this before, but this is what they're marketing as the final major patch for Baldur's Gate 3, patch 8. And I believe we've talked about patch 8 previously, like when it was first being detailed, what it would include, including a lot of the new subclasses. So each main class has a new subclass. Like, for instance, Fighter has the Arcane Archer, Paladin has Oath of the Crown, Druid has Circle of Stars, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't have enough D&D knowledge to really key in on any of those. Be like, ooh, finally, the Hexblade. Like, it sounds neat, but I don't have that. But they're adding all of it as part of this update. They're making some additions to the modding kit. I guess patch 7, but the modding kit was relatively recently added for the full dev tools for mods. They're bringing some quality of life updates to those. And then another big one is full crossplay. So crossplay between console, PC, even PC and Mac. So obviously Baldur's Gate 3, when it was first announced, was announced at a Stadia event, if everyone forgets, but specifically to help facilitate people going out, you know, forming their party and adventuring together. And still holds through, you know, today when they're trying to, you know, say that no matter what console you play on, you can cross-play with other people from other consoles, with your own file to other consoles, or PC or Mac. So obviously a well-supported game ever since it was fully announced, ever since it was in early access. So not really surprised to see it still continue to the final patch. Oh, photo mode is also new. I'm actually surprised it didn't already have that. But
I thought it already had it too, yeah.
And then the most recently released of the games on this, we got some news still trickling in from the announcement of the Rido Remastered, The Mystery of the Soulless Army, first showed up at the Switch event. Do I have this right? It first showed up at the Switch event, and then it showed up again at the Switch 2 event, just saying, yes, it'll also release on Switch 2 when Switch 2 comes out.
Yeah, I believe that's right.
That sounds right, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and so now we've already gotten some of the details. Like, we already knew that it was greatly improving the demon roster. I guess the original game only had like 70, and now it's getting 50 more. I believe I have those numbers right.
Yeah, I remember the original game was definitely pretty narrow, but despite having some pretty unique ones.
It says over 50 new demons, bringing the total to over 120. So yeah, about right. Including ones that appear originally in the sequel, Devenal Summoner 2 versus King Abaddon. As well as they specifically call out Shin Megami Tensei 5 Vengeance. So more contemporary demons being kind of ported back into the remaster for Rido and the Mystery of the Soulless Army. They talk about, now these, you'll have to just tell me, Adam or others, if they are completely new features or if they're revamped from how the original game worked. Talks about Rido having summoner skills, combat skills versus sword skills, and how you like have to gather materials to build different equipment that you would use in combat. And then also about demon loyalty and how those can kind of give you titles, where the longer you use a demon, the more loyal they are to you, which unlocks titles that allow you to control
more
demons.
I think
some of the
stuff was in the sequel in some form, but not in the original. I don't remember specifically exactly how the mechanics worked, but I know a lot of this stuff, you know, the sequel added a bunch, and it sounds like it's sort of being kind of not backported.
It would be bad for the marketing of this game, but it kind of wish they just had like, here's what we took for this sequel and put it into this game, god damn it.
Yeah,
so at least refresh our memory that way for the old heads, because I am also very pleased. I'm like, well, the sequel was so much better, but like, was this just in the sequel? Mm-hmm. But definitely, like the battle camera and the way you move around 3D in the battles is definitely new to this game, and that's not bummed from this. That's just the pace of combat being like way faster paced to this game. That's definitely something that's new to this game for sure. Like the dodge rolling and like dedicated jump button to evade attacks on some of like the footage that's come out from the Japanese outlets when they were previewing this game. I'm like, oh yeah, that's due to this game. Yeah, there's a lot of like fun little touches as well. I mean, there's definitely some like you can see like the demons like mermaid from SMT5 like making it into this game. But the one that really I think some people called that on social media too. But they added Belphegor from into this game, and people will know Belphegor as the demon that sits on a toilet, especially like if people played Persona 5. Belphegor was one of the first major bosses, but the toilet in this game that it's sitting on is a period appropriate toilet. It's not like a modern toilet. It's like a wooden box that it's sitting on. It's like, okay, all right, Atlas, that's pretty good, assholes.
Normally he's just on like a porcelain regular toilet, right?
Yeah, exactly. That was pretty good. But they also have Cybele, Turbo Granny, I forgot, Pavelsag, I think it was like the scorpion-esque demon. Some others, just, you know, cool to see, like, filling out the roster for this game, always good.
A couple other smaller trailer updates for some upcoming games. Here's one on indie game we've covered a few different times over the last 3 years or so. Demon School, this game has unfortunately been in a little bit of a development, I don't want to say hell, it's a little bit poetic, but it was originally supposed to release earlier in 2024, got pushed back. It's now announced during the Galaxy's Gaming Showcase that Demon School is slated to launch this summer. Alongside this, they showed off, the game has been showed off in so many different contexts, but more look at the game's mini games, and quickly thumbing through the trailer, it shows like a cooking mini game, like a karaoke slash dating mini game of some sorts. So really kind of shows that this game is going to be like a fully featured RPG with all the little like window dressings that, you know, these sorts of games have. But the kind of this is the game that kind of has like the early Persona, occult, Shin Megami Tensei sort of vibes. I know there's a few other points of comparison that we made.
Italian horror was the big thing for this game, like very inspired by Italian horror.
Oh yep, Italian horror. So
yeah, I remember the delay that they got last year. Like the developers were pretty much like at a fork in the road. Like they were at a state where, like, they could technically release it, but they weren't fully satisfied with like the scope of the game that they were supposed to release. Like it's like it's not the full vision or the ideal vision of our game. So it's like we could release this now and like have it in people's hands already, or we could continue to or just delay it a little bit more to really fully realize our vision for it. And so they chose that option, and hopefully it works out. You know, I'm still very interested in it, and I wish them the best of luck. Like that is not an easy decision to make, especially if you're pushing it back for what, almost a year at this point, since it's like original, you know, when it was supposed to release at that state in time, after already like some other delays in the past.
We got a new trailer for the upcoming Elden Ring Nightreign, another one of the playable classes. This one is the Raider, which before we did the, I forget the name of the character, the Duchess, was it? The Black Knight, the very agile, evasive character. This is the opposite. This is basically a character that has, you know, heavy armor, enormous weapons, has a lot of stagger resistance, doesn't get hit stunned. So basically just the big, giant, tanking brute, doesn't have a lot of mobility, but has a lot of fortitude.
A real class. Yeah, for real hardcore gamers.
I saw that Mikhail this week put up like 3 trailers in 4 days for the Fantasy Life, the girl who steams time, this girl who steals time, coming out in late May. So they had different trailers for basically just questing and job switching, about mercenaries, about being a miner. So I'll be honest, I did not watch all these trailers through front to back, but they're really kind of speedrunning the nearing the release month marketing for Fantasy Life.
Yeah, so I mean, makes sense.
All the different snippets of gameplay for that game.
Yeah, I mean, it's coming up, you know, just in a month's time. So that time to really boost the marketing on it. You know, it seems cool. I mean, I'll definitely give it a shot and try it out and see if I like it. I'm interested in it now that it's like...
Hope it's good. I hope they send review codes to people this time.
I don't know. We'll see. Who knows? The girl who steals review codes.
We have a handful of dates here covering like the mid-spring to early summer. This first one is actually about an information stream that's coming up. We talked about the recently announced Super Robot Wars Y, kind of brought it up in passing when talking about Gundam Degeneration. There'll be a series information stream on April 20th that will talk about Super Robot Wars Y, as well as Super Robot Wars DD, which is the ongoing mobile game.
Yeah, this is this is what I've been waiting for. So usually, you know, they have the occasional SRW stream like for DD announcements or whatever, and like, no, I don't personally care, so I don't play it. That's cool for people to do, but this is the one that I'm waiting for. Okay, they have a new SRW console game coming out this year. They only showed a little bit of the series coming to it, but I assume just in a few hours, early morning tomorrow at 3 a.m., they're gonna unveil like the rest of the series coming to SRWY, and it'll have all my hopes and dreams and wishes along with it, and I'm going to be a very happy person after the end of it. So this is right now, this is kind of like the most important gaming thing for me in the immediate future, is for the series list to be fucking awesome, and that I love it. The ones that I'm really, really gunning for and crossing my fingers for are like Grand Bell and Rin No Lagrange. I don't expect anyone to know that. It's okay for people who do. You're a real one. But we'll see. I'm ready to be surprised and entertained, and you know, I'm ready to play a new SRW again for like the umpteenth time in my life. I don't know. It's been too much to count. I'm here for more.
Looks like May 7th, Toho Spell Carnival, which released on Switch and PlayStation back in 2024, will be coming to Steam on May 7th. In addition, there'll be a limited edition available on Idea Factory's international store. So that'll get a Steam port. Late in May, this is a game that's already released on Steam. This is from East Asia Soft, called Starlight Legacy. I guess we're released on Steam in February. It'll be releasing on Switch, PlayStation, and Xbox on May 28th. Steam version only has a very small number of reviews, but they are positive. We have an indie tactical RPG, Cyber Knights Flashpoint, releasing on June 2nd for Steam. Dune Awakening, this is like the MMO-ish, survival-ish open-world game by Funcom. Was originally supposed to release on May 20th. It was moved back a few weeks and will be now launching on June 10th. Adam, is this the one Junior was playing? Can I say that?
Am I allowed to say that? I think we got beta access, but I think Scott was playing it.
Oh, Scott, okay. And it was a beta access, okay.
Just in time for when after the Switch 2 comes out and after all the SGF stuff is happening.
Mm.
Oh my god. The fact that Switch 2 is releasing, I think, literally the day before SGF starts is like, come on.
Yeah. I'm still trying to think of how I'm going to navigate that. Oh yeah, I guess we should mention, out of nowhere here, since as a follow-up, Nintendo did announce that they finally have a date of when they're going to start pre-orders in North America, or the United States and Canada. And that's April 24th, right? Half the date correct,
April 24th,
right?
What I'm doing is I'm actually, since my local store is like a mom and pop, they can't guarantee they're going to get anything for launch, and they're not going to take pre-orders. So I do not trust online pre-orders because of bots and all that bullshit. So I'm actually going to be giving my money, or more specifically, my Xbox to GameStop to get a pre-order in. So.
Yeah, there's a GameStop and a Best Buy near here. I might try to do the Best Buy one because it's near where I work.
Will you be able to pick it up before SGF starts, though?
If they have, I think they're doing midnight releases. If they do midnight releases, then yeah, because
yeah, that would be because you're West Coast, so it would be 9 p.m. So are you flying out like the morning of the 5th?
I haven't got a ticket yet. The partially because of this, but I'm probably gonna get a ticket sometime very, very soon. I also had to get an enhanced driver's license because they're doing all the real ID stuff starting beginning of May. So you need to have if you want to make it painless to travel domestically, flying, enhanced driver's license is the way to go.
Yeah.
Other than that, you get a lot more additional paperwork.
I haven't bothered to do that just because I have a passport, so I just bring my passport.
That works.
Yeah, I've had the real ID on my driver's license for I feel like years now, but they kept delaying the
enhanced
requirements.
The enhanced driver's license is slightly different from real ID. It's a mess. Being in the U.S.,
but I do have a passport too. So
I have no idea what you guys are talking about since I don't live in the U.S.
Please don't come here, Chow.
We're Canadians. We're enemies now.
do not travel to the U.S., Chow. We love you. I have to sort all that out before looking to a ticket, but gonna get one very soon, and then I have to think about how gonna do the Switch 2 thing, and I guess it depends on how the pre-order shit shakes out. So I guess that was a good just a follow-up, hey, if you're listening and you're still wondering when's the pre-order date, April 24th in North America.
I have the perfect
Canada
excuse for Alex. It's like, he'll be like, hey, it's like, I need you to do these guides. It's like, well, I didn't get a Switch 2, sorry. No dice here.
Dang. I'm pretty excited, and I do think that genuinely, if you're going for a Switch 2, since GameStops are going to have their own allotment, if you can get to a GameStop an hour or so before open, the day that pre-orders go live, you should be good, I think. Probably.
It's Chad, did you see the Canadian prices for all the Switch 2 stuff go up?
Yeah, I saw it, but when they announced it, it was like, it seems like it was the same price as the American one, then they took it down like a week later after they have like new tariff news, and then now they're putting it back. I don't know. It's so confusing. This entire thing's a fiasco.
Yeah, but it's the CAD not good on this. You have really expensive shit on your end when it comes to Switch 2 accessories and all that stuff. It's like 124 CAD for like a Joy-Con.
Well, you know,
I think
what's
it's
a good
for
thing?
Both Joy-Cons, not just one.
I know, yeah. But at least if we could use the Switch Pro controller from the original system, so I guess
can't wake up the system though. And apparently, the D-pad, the Switch 2 Pro controller's D-pad, is better. How much better? Who knows? But
that is annoying. You can't wake it up from with a Switch 1 Pro controller. That's annoying.
They always got some incentive to force you to buy the next generation controllers.
I know.
I'm debating getting a Switch 2 Pro controller. If it was just the same thing, then I wouldn't, even for the D-pad. But the fact that it does have the back buttons, I have an 8-bit do. But I'll be honest, I don't like the 8-bit do Ultimate's D-pad very much.
So, oh, really?
Hmm. Yeah. It's too stiff.
Hmm. Yeah, I haven't used one, but I generally hear people praise back buttons, even though I've never really used them. But
yeah, it's like, you know,
yeah, they're great.
Yeah, I'm not a big back controller.
I actually really wish that my Xbox Elite controller wasn't basically breaking on itself, because I'm going through like Ninja Gaiden Black and Ninja Gaiden 2 finally, because I'm trading in that Xbox, and it's like I should probably go through these like last minute before I get rid of this thing. And it's like,
I mean,
man,
don't you just have to play Ninja Gaiden Black 2? I mean, technically you could get Black 1 on PC and all that other stuff, right?
No. The collections on PC are based off the Sigma versions.
Yeah. No, but they released a new Black on PC.
Well, Ninja Gaiden 2 Black is based off the Sigma version still.
It's not the original Black.
I've heard people argue that it might be the best way to play that game, but there's still reasons to want to play the 360 original of Ninja Gaiden 2.
Yeah.
Oh. Oh, best of luck. Yeah. The Master Ninja difficulty cleared, I guess.
I'm not doing that. Hell no. I actually got like 2/3 of the way through Ninja Gaiden Black my first time playing through it, and I got like hard blocked by the one boss that apparently everyone that gets blocked in that game does, because it traps you. You're probably thinking of the one I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
It's like, man, this save point, it's so good that I was able to find the save point after this one-way passage. Uh-oh. I don't have healing items. Uh-oh.
Fun times.
God, I love those games. They're just so good. Like, I don't know. I haven't seen games made like when enemies are this aggressive and every grunt feels like a menace.
Yeah, there were certainly games of that era. They're awesome, and I hope the new one's good too.
On the Japan side of things, East 10 Proud Nordix will be launching on the Switch 2 on July 31st.
Go for it, James.
So far, it looks like it's only a Switch 2 version, and unlike with the Trails in the Sky remake, this is like 3 months away, and there's no other platforms announced. I think this might just only be Switch 2 for a bit. That's
Switch 2 exclusive, baby.
Also, the web commercial they released for it is 30 FPS, whereas the web commercial they released for the original East 10 was 60, which implies that this might be 30 FPS with no 60 FPS mode.
Down.
That's like,
that doesn't sound good.
Oh shit.
Two more game dates here. I believe this one's pronounced Hike Northern Lights, Hyke. This is like a pixel-based JRPG. Will be launching this summer for PlayStation, Nintendo Switch, and Steam.
This is cool. I want to check this out. I was already pretty interested after its announcement, but it's like seems like an action RPG where you switch between like different witches in real time to like fire off different spells, and there's like a whole camping element for like cozy character interactions, cooking and all that stuff. It seems
there's a very short part of the trailer where someone's wearing a pink bunny suit and punching enemies. So
hell yeah, there we go.
Seems pretty neat.
That's big witch stuff right there.
Marissa of Liartop Mountain, this is a Toho Project game, I believe, will be launching on September 19th, and they've announced that they're adding a Switch version to the, I guess, previously announced Steam version of the game. It'll launch simultaneously on both platforms. And then, like, looking forward to next week, or, you know, I don't know how much we're looking forward to this, but and we have a tease from Furyu, our favorite teasing company. They're working on a new RPG, like school setting RPG, apparently, from the Monarch team, from Team Noir.
The goats are back, am I right?
No, Team Noir. This is, I don't know, I treat Furyu a little bit better than Bushiroad, but I put them almost in the same tier.
Yeah.
That's a really funny statement. I treat Furyu a little bit better than Bushiroad, but they're in the same tier. I love that. what are you hoping for, Chow, out of Team Noir?
Something good?
Okay.
Is that too hard to ask?
That seems like a tall order. I don't know. I have no idea what to expect. It's like a school-themed project, RPG, I guess. I'm looking at some of the key staff members that Kite pointed out here. I don't know. Gakuto Mikumu, who worked on Strike the Blood, MGS Portable Ops, and MG Survive.
Okay, so it has a nice catchphrase. So it'll be, Senpai, I can take care of this.
don't put Strike the Blood jokes in this podcast. That seems cursed. And, you know, Tsukasa Masuko, the BGM composer, and then accompanying Ryotaro Ito was Mikumo, but Ito is also still going to be the scenario writer on this, and Kazunari Suzuki as the scenario. So they're going to have a full reveal on April 24. I guess there's a teaser site that has like Japanese phrases on it as the teaser. And there's been like a few like images, teaser images on their social media.
I don't. What if they surprise you that they're making a new Caligula effect game?
I mean, some people would be excited. Some people really like Caligula too. I don't have any attachment to Caligula. I watched the anime adaptation of Caligula, and I was like, this is okay, I guess. But I tried playing Caligula 1, like the remake, and I got really bored really fast. So that ended my Caligula adventure. When I gave it a shot, I was like, this game is boring. So I don't know. I don't know what to expect. I mean, it's going to be one of those days that's like the unveil of this game is going to have like the staff, and it's gonna, like, this person worked on like the game that you loved 25 years ago, and like, oh yeah, they're fucking back.
And they're not back, and they give you shit like Ray Natus or something.
They'll give you Monarch. But I mean,
I forgot about Ray Natus. Like, that's not, I don't know, how long ago was that? Like 2 months?
It was September last year.
Oh wait, okay, so it was last year. Okay.
Yeah, you get all these big names, and it's like, why is this game like game of the year? And you get this, so.
So yeah, I guess stay tuned, and I guess we'll talk about this next week when it gets revealed, and then we'll be like, is it going to be good? And we're like, eh, probably not, but we'll see.
Monarch 2.
If it's Monarch 2, then... I mean, Monarch had a school element to it. I mean, it was school-themed, and Monarch, it just wasn't, you know, revealed as that.
I forgot, who revealed Monarch?
God.
Oh.
And I played it too.
I remember the Monarch teaser was like that. They kept on pushing the staff. They worked on the original Megami Tensei, not Shin Megami Tensei. And then like the teaser was like, you go called in to like a phone number, and they gave you like really like ominous messages over the phone. And that was their teaser. And they're like, all right.
Okay.
This was at a time, well, during an era where we're like, okay, we'll give Furyu a shot because like they're bringing out like these vets of like really old.
Yeah, Japanese, and the vets games did not help. And so then, it needs to be everybody else.
We got Furyu, and then Furyu kept on doing Furyu stuff. We're like, we can't keep falling for this.
So obviously next week, one of the game that we will be talking about is we have a few things releasing kind of on top of each other. We've of course got the Clair Obscur Expedition 33. We've got 100 Line, I believe, is next week.
Yep.
Was there one other thing? I forget.
I've got to get the Fatal Fury game. I'm sorry, guys.
There's Clair Obscur, 100 Line, and Phantom Brave on PC.
Phantom Brave on PC, oh, yeah, which, man, they chose the worst time to, like, anyone that would have been interested in Phantom Brave, it's probably just picking up 100 Line. I feel bad for them.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to say. I just heard that the console versions of Phantom Brave Lost Hero didn't really work out. That's tough.
Yasha Legend of the Demon Blade was going to release on the 24th, but it got pushed back.
I'm interested in checking out Clair Obscur. I want to pick that up. And
yeah, I'm interested too. I hear nothing but good things about it. So
100 Line, I'll wait for people because I didn't really like the demo. I need someone to really sell me that, like, the demo wasn't really a great indicator. Like, someone's probably going to have to tell me it's like it gets good like 40 hours in or something. Like, oh, I'm very excited.
Mm-hmm. So obviously a lot of big games to talk about next week, so stay tuned for those. Again, thank you to Paul, who had to leave early, and then Chao, of course, for covering the Lunar Remastered review and discussion here earlier in the podcast. Josh for talking about G-Generation Eternal, and then the rest for covering the rest of the news with me. If you like this podcast, whatever podcast service of choice you listen to us on, leave us a like, leave us a rating, leave us a thumbs up. We'd like to see those. Leave us a comment on the site post if you're feeling so inclined. Follow RPG Site on all the social media networks. Just search for RPG Space Site and you should be able to find us. Join our Discord, discord.gg/RPG Site. And until you hear from us next time, stay safe, take care, and we'll talk to y'all next week.
Oh my God, next podcast is going to be long as hell.